Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 25th, 1999. We're in the fireside room of Koinonia this evening. Today's session number is 99-8. Your presenter is Christy Traina. Today's session is entitled Poetics of Nature. Let's listen in.
Toss up after him like a rope ladder home. Is there, even if Christ holds the tip of things fast, and stretches eternity clear to the dim souls of men, is there no link at the base of things? Some kernel or air deep in the matrix of matter from which universe furls like a ribbon twined into time. Has God a hand in this? Then it is a good hand. But has he a hand at all? Or is he a holy fire, burning self-contained for power's sake alone? Then he knows himself blissfully as flame unconsuming, as all brilliance and beauty and power, and the rest of us can go hang. Then the accidental universe spins mute, obedient only to its own gross terms, meaningless out of mind and alone. The universe is neither contingent upon nor participant in the holy, in being itself, the real, the power play of fire. The universe is illusion merely, not one speck of it real, and we are not only its victims falling away, falling always into or smashed by a planet slung by its sun, but also its captives, bound by the mineral-made ropes of our senses. But how do we know? How could we know that the real is there? By what freak chance does the skin of illusion ever split and reveal to us the real, which seems to know us by name? And by what freak chance, and why, did the capacity to prehend it evolve? I'm sorry for cutting off the last line in the Xerox process. Okay. Where is God? What do you see here? Or hear here? And for those of you who came in late, maybe a few people in front could hand around the sheets that we're looking at. They're right here in front. Thanks.
She's everybody? Playing with two ideas. She's playing with the old, age-old question of the problem of evil.
Right.
And she's also sort of playing with deism. You know, it's not simply the watchmaker who set the watch moving and then walked away to let it run by its own rules. And her prose is beautiful. It's very wonderful. It's wonderful prose.
What else? Or anybody, if anyone wants to expand on those images of reality and illusion and God, the distant overseer.
Well, she seems to be able, she seems confident that this one event somehow is definitive for her.
Mm-hmm.
That this one event of suffering pretty much swings the pendulum on the side of an absent God or an uncaring God or a very weak God or whatever. God, a helpless, our baby to bear, whatever.
Which one does she prefer? Those are the options.
Well, I question that you can make any judgment based on one event. That God is so much greater than our ability to comprehend single events or even multiple events. I'm reminded of what Alan Watts said about our limited ability to understand God and the really big picture. He said each one of our lives was like a brief flash of light. And so imagine all of our lives as flashes of light in the universe. And of course, there's this continuum of flashes from the beginning of our species until, you know, some millions of years hence to presumably some new evolution. What is the sum total? How do we comprehend what these flashes of light are? You know, using kind of a modern analogy that he wouldn't have been able to use because it was before his time, I think of all of the events that we experience as like little pixels of light, and really God can only comprehend what is being displayed on the picture screen of reality. And this one person who had burns on her face is one brief flicker of one pixel of a megapixel screen. And so you can't say, well, just because this little pixel flashed this way, I can understand what the big screen says.
You've pointed me toward owning up to the structure of the book, which, because we're not reading the whole thing, I had started out giving you. The way that it begins, and this is following up on your point, okay. The way that it begins is in this way. This is the first paragraph, or two paragraphs. Every day is a god. Each day is a god. And holiness holds forth in time. I worship each god. I praise each day splintered down and wrapped in time like a husk of many colors spreading at dawn fast over the mountains split. I wake in a god. I wake in arms holding my quilt, holding me as best they can inside my quilt. And her poetic sensibility all through the first of these three chapters, of which we read from the central chapter, okay, she's very aware of what the god of the day is. Is the god of the day playful? Is the god of the day solemn? Is the god of the day absent? Is the god of the day benevolent and generous? And it turns out that each of the days at the beginning of the book has a different sort of god. Not meaning that there are many gods, but that the god that she experiences daily is quite different. What happens with Julie and the burns is that the god of that day suddenly has an overwhelming presence. That she wonders if the god of the other days really was a god. Right? And this god suddenly becomes the looming presence on the horizon, the god of the day, of the burn. And so, very much like you said, right, she envisions God with infinite dimensions, right? But suddenly this one is so overwhelmingly horrifying that she has to stop and examine it. And so she asks the question, is all this real? Right? And if it isn't real, or if it isn't good, then what? Any other thoughts that come from this piece?
Yes. I'm reminded of one line from J.B. by Archibald MacLeish. If God is God, he is not good. If God is good, he is not God. And neither horn of that dilemma gives us much to hang on to.
Unless we have misdefined God or misunderstood good.
And of course, it's the Satan character whose line I just quoted.
Right. And so in a sense, this is the question, is God as we have thought of God? And is goodness as we have thought of goodness? This is the question, the day on which the rug is pulled out and she wonders, is what's around me real? Is it the creation of a good God? Or is it really a mask? And if it is a mask, how do I figure out what is real? Where is the illusion lying? She goes on and recovers from this moment, and I'll read a bit of that in two places. She draws back and names that one of her projects in Puget Sound has been to chart the islands that she can see from her water tower and to name them. Naming is very important in this book, that the significance of names and of being able to put a label on something, on a piece of knowledge. So she says, she's looking out the window again, not having heard any news. And now outside the window, deep on the horizon, a new thing appears, as if we needed a new thing. It is a new land, blue beyond islands, hitherto hidden by haze and now revealed, and as dumb as the rest. I check my chart, my amateur penciled sketch of the skyline. Yes, this land is new. This spread blue spark beyond yesterday's new wrinkled line, beyond the blue veil a sailor said was Salt Spring Island. How long can this go on? But let us, by all means, extend the scope of our charts. I draw it as I seem to see it, a blue chunk fitted just so beyond islands, a wag of graphite rising just here above another anonymous line, and here meeting the slope of Salt Spring. Though whether this be headland I see or heartland or the distance blurred bluffs of 100 bays, I have no way of knowing. Or if it be island or main. I call it Thule, O Julia Land, Time's Bad News. I name it Terror, the farthest limb of the day, God's Tooth. And this becomes a piece of God, right, rather than all of God. But we extend the scope of our charts to encompass ever new visions of what the divine includes. And we're always shocked to find out what that is, although the meaning of it, of this piece of divinity, is not clear to her yet. One more little bit near the end, so that you don't have the feeling that she leaves you in this horrible place for a long time. Time and space are in touch with the absolute at its base. Eternity sockets twice into time, and space curves bound and bound by idea. Matter and spirit are of a piece, but distinguishable. God has a stake guaranteed in all the world, and the universe is real and not a dream, not a manufacture of the senses. Subject may know object. Knowledge may proceed, and wholly the firm is, in short, the philosopher's stone. There is such a thing as the real that can be known, that is at base grounded in God. And she regains this confidence at the end after being overwhelmed by the God of that day. Thoughts on the end of this. It's unfair reading it to you, I know.
What does the word kenotic mean?
Kenotic means self-emptying. Christ's death on the cross is described by Christian theologians as his kenosis, his self-emptying for the sake of others, his complete act of loving sacrifice for us. So that's the origin. Is this a comfortable vision of God? Is it sharp-edged? How does it feel? Yes.
Well, to me, it is a God that can easily accommodate any extreme catastrophe and any extreme wonder, positive thing. Mm-hmm. So, bring this to the subject of ecology. Mm-hmm. I think this God could easily accommodate the complete end of all life on this planet. An eco-utopia on this planet. I think this kind of a God can span the full range of possible outcomes, from the most ugly and horrifying to the most glorious and wonderful. So from that standpoint, I'm not sure if that helps us much. If that kind of God helps us. It's a very honest way of understanding God. The way I it's kind of close actually to my vision of God, but then my vision goes beyond this planet to the many planets of the many galaxies in the whole universe, many of which has intelligent life on it, and then I applied certain notions of probability to that maybe 0.1% of all of these planets with intelligent beings will not be destroyed by those intelligent beings. But God cares about that 0.1% of planets.
That shows.
And then the question is, are we smart enough to be that 0.1% of planetary systems in the universe that we can live on for the long term sustainably with our great intelligence and our great power?
One of the powerful things about Dillard is her extraordinary honesty about the ugly, the painful, the need for us to eat each other, and about death. An extraordinarily strong realism that implies that this is not outside God's vision for us, that this is a part of the world that God has created, and one of the great mysteries of God is why that should be and what it all means. The other fascinating thing about her work is her ability to describe this in a way that makes God extremely large. And environmental sensibility requires us either to make God very small and weak, as she says, or so large that we can't even imagine the significance of ourselves in comparison with God. And this is one very strong response, theologically and spiritually, within the environmental movement, which is to imagine that God is much larger than we have imagined. God is much larger than... we used to think that God chose the Israelites. Then we decided that God chose anybody who accepted Jesus Christ, so God chose a few more people, Then we thought, God accepts pretty much the contemporary vision is that God chooses everyone on earth. Well, what if God chooses the entire universe? That might sometimes mean that our interests will lose out. And this is a kind of God that has evolved out of the environmental movement in some places. Except that I would urge you to read Dillard, because there is a lot of hope and confidence in there. It is not merely sort of a depressing reduction of the self to a tiny speck. She manages to put us in a realistically against the backdrop of an enormous horizon, and yet to find God and prayer and God's love in there for us. And so it's a marvelous way of setting ourselves in context and yet retaining that connection. What I want to go through next is very, very different. Terry Tempest Williams is a naturalist with the Utah Museum of Natural History. She is a Mormon. She is what we call a nature writer. But her response to the landscape she sees is quite different from Annie Dillard's. Annie Dillard even calls herself in her works a nun, in a way, in all of the self-denying senses. Terry Tempest Williams' work cannot be described as anything else but sensual, I would say. This book, she has several marvelous books, and Unspoken Hunger, which is in the bookstore, and the picture on the front actually is what goes with the first part of the quartet, which we're discussing. A marvelous book of essays on the natural world and the importance of it and her experiences as a naturalist and some of her contacts with naturalists of earlier generations. She has a book called Refuge, which connects her nature writing to the experience of her mother's cancer and accompanying her mother through that. Many fascinating works. Desert Quartet is an artistic experiment, and we can't get the full force of it in this group, but I urge you to look at it if it speaks to you at all. The four elements in classical philosophy are earth, air, fire, and water. So she does four little meditations on these elements in the desert and her connection to them. It has artwork by a colleague of hers. I have two excerpts in here from the Earth chapter. I'm going to read the whole chapter, it's quite short, to you now though, so that you have a sense of what she's doing and what kind of spirituality this might be moving us toward. This is Earth. Earth, rock, desert. I am walking barefoot on sandstone. Flesh responding to flesh. It is hot. So hot the rock threatens to burn through the calloused soles of my feet. I must quicken my pace, paying attention to where I step. For as far as I can see, the canyon country of southern Utah extends in all directions. No compass can orient me here, only a pledge to love and walk the terrifying distances before me. What I fear and desire most in this world is passion. I fear it because it promises to be a spontaneous, out of my control, unnamed, beyond my reasonable self. I desire it because passion has color, like the landscape before me. It is not pale. It is not neutral. It reveals the backside of the heart. I climb the slick rock on all fours, my hands and feet throbbing with the heat. It feels good to sweat, to be engaged, to inhabit my animal body. My destination is Druid Arch by way of the Joint Trail in Chesler Park, located in the southeastern corner of Canyonlands known as the Needles. I have no map, only cairns to guide me, the hand-stacked piles of rocks that say, trust me, turn here, I know the way. Many resist cairns in the desert, kick them down, believing each traveler should walk on their own authority. It is also true some cairns have been designed to fool people, to trick them off the trail so they will become lost forever. A quick lesson in self-reliance, to never believe in the stories of others. But I believe our desire to share is more potent and trustworthy than our desire to be alone. And so I do not anticipate these markers will lie. To walk in this country is always an act of faith. The cairns I've followed here have not secured my own path to intimacy as much as they have given me the courage to proceed, one foot in front of the other, in a landscape mysterious, unpredictable, and vast. Nobody really knows the way. That is the myth of convention. Cedar Mesa formations of sandstone envelop me. These pastel cliffs could convince you that you are a hostage with no way out. But the various shales, softer in character, create the slopes and benches to climb out of one canyon into the heart of another. Once I enter the Joint Trail, it is as though I am walking through the inside of an animal. It is dark, cool, and narrow, with sheer sandstone walls on either side of me. I look up, a slit of sky above. Light is deceptive here. The palms of my hands search for a pulse in the rocks. I continue walking, In some places, my hips can barely fit through. I turn sideways, my chest and back in a vice of geologic time. I stop. The silence that lives in these sacred hallways presses against me. I relax. I surrender. I close my eyes. The arousal of my breath rises in me like music, like love, as the possessive muscles between my legs tighten and release. I come to the rock in a moment of stillness, giving and receiving, where there is no partition between my body and the body of Earth. There are always logical explanations for the loss of one's mind in the desert. The parallel and intersecting maze I have been traveling through is tortured rock pulled apart by internal tensions and stresses that form fractures in Earth. These fractures become susceptible to erosion, creating deep slots between fins of sandstone. Through the weathering of our spirit, the erosion of our soul, we are vulnerable. Isn't that what passion is? Bodies broken open through change? We are acted upon. We invite and accept the life of another to take root inside. The succession of canyons is like our own. A maidenhair fern hangs from the slick rock. Water drips, drips, drips until I catch it in my mouth. Drink deeply, the desert sighs. For the next few miles, I simply walk through the pastoral country of Chesler Park, meadows of serenity. This landscape will take care of me. The open expanse of sky makes me realize how necessary it is to live without words, to be satisfied without answers, to simply be in a world where there is no wind, no drama, to find a place of rest and safety, no matter how fleeting it may be, no matter how illusory, is to regain composure and locate bearings. Picking up stones, I find myself adding to the cairns. Elephant Canyon is composed of limestone ledges, turquoise and lavender stairs that eventually lead desert pilgrims to Druid Arch. The vegetation is lush as clumps of milkweed. Their orange fluorescence attract monarchs in migration. Willows, oak, and single-leaf ash provide cover for collared lizards and towhees. Their shuffling in the dry leaf litter reminds me of all I do not see. And the potholes, sinks of water in the sandstone, beckon me down on hands and knees for a closer look. The minutiae of mosquito and mayfly larvae, fairy shrimp, tadpoles, and diving beetles is swirling with its own sense of urgency. Perhaps this is the mind of the lover, manic and driven, the shallow pools of expectation that inevitably dry up. Why is it for most of us the vision of the erotic comes as a rare event? A shooting star, a flash flood, a moment of exotic proportion and not in a stable condition. In this tiny body of water in the desert, I detect waves. I think of the ocean, wave after wave breaking on shore in interminable monotony, yet witnessed one by one, they can hold us in trance for hours. The afternoon has delivered me to Druid Arch. Nothing has prepared me for this insistence of being, the pure artistry of shape and form standing quietly, magnificently, in the canyons of Utah. Red rock, blue sky. This arch is structured metamorphosis. Once a fin-like tower, it has been perforated by a massive cave-in, responsible now for the keyholes where wind enters and turns. What has been opened, removed, eroded away is as compelling to me as what remains. Druid Arch, inorganic matter, rock rising from the desert floor as a creation of time, weathered, broken, and beautiful. I touch the skin of my face. It seems so callow. Moving my fingers over the soft flesh that covers my cheekbones, I wonder what it means to be human, and why, at this particular moment, rock seems more accessible and yielding than my own species. What's here?
We don't hear very many odes to rocks.
No, we don't, do we?
But they're really, really quite dynamic. We took the trail today, and there's a giant boulder that came down from off the ridge up there.
Right.
It's huge and so beautiful. It's just so neat. I think she's right on.
Rocks contain an incredible amount of history, don't they? And you know, the sediments or the lava, and then the compression or and heat that create the rock, and then it gets broken off, and not only is it broken off, then it's weathered so it can be round. The stages in the life of a rock are incredible to contemplate. And so it's they aren't just stuff, but history in a way, aren't they? Yeah. What else is here?
Like a relationship with the person almost, the earth almost as a living what works to use, but
it's a subject.
The earth gives, you give and take, and the earth gives and takes back.
Right.
It's reciprocal in a way.
Right. It's reciprocal, and it helps to have thought of the rock as living. Right. Which makes the rock as a subject to relate to not such a strange idea at all. It's a very intimate connection for her in every way. Anything else you see here?
I don't know exactly where this fits, but the rock is very clear about its boundaries. You may climb me,
right.
And you may slip. If you climb, you'll get a beautiful view.
Uh-huh.
If you slip. there is a way to relate to it, and you're always sure what the rock's perspective is.
Right. And those of us who've gone climbing around here have had a few reminders of that, I think. I have one or two in my shins today. So yes, that's very true.
And you can't be so sure of other humans. We don't always know what they're thinking. We try to approach. We don't always know what we're going to get back in return. But you know what you're going to get from a rock.
And she says, "Why? You know, why is it that a rock seems more accessible than a person? Right? Because the rock can be read, and the rock stay still most of the time, right? I was struck on a second or third or fourth reading by the way she throws the word passion in here. What does passion mean for her, or what does it mean for you after hearing this?
Well, she's not just looking at the earth and noticing factual bits of information about it. She's it's a lot of feeling putting
in. Entering into a relationship with it.
I almost wonder if she's inferring passion in the rock. I mean, she's making this emotional connection to what we would probably just see as hard stuff, and she's this whole thing is an emotional connection, and then isn't that what passion is? Bodies broken open through change. And all of a sudden it struck me, that boulder coming on the hill, that you could use that same language about what rocks go through too.
Right. That the earth,
I wondered if she
right. The earth is broken open by change, and how is the arch formed? Right? Through erosion. Through its vulnerability. You look at the arch and you think, wow, what a solid, strong thing. And yet the arch is there because the rock is vulnerable to the wind, right? And so for both humanity and the earth, passion comes through vulnerability and change, right? And that's another way of connecting us to the earth, the need for vulnerability in order to enter into relationship, and the seeing of the earth as a vulnerable being rather than as this hard, strong thing that we oppose ourselves to. Any other pieces that come out of this? There's one painfully, patently obvious bit about quite sexual passion, right? And this isn't a kind of, what do I want to say, sublimated passion, but it's, she makes it quite clearly physical. And in every chapter of this text, she does that. Another way of gaining union with the earth. But I want to point us in another direction there too. There are a few of us in our community who are Eastern Orthodox, and those of you who are will be aware of this. The Reformation has caused us to forget that there are more than one Christian way of loving. The Reformation taught us that we should be kenotic, self-emptying, selfless, the love of agape. There is another Christian love. That is the love of eros. Okay? Now, not necessarily physically sexual, but the love which desires above all the greatest good, which desires to be united with God, the ultimate good. And this is expressed in language of longing, of desire, and quite naturally in the spiritual tradition, very often sexually. So she's drawing on a very old tradition. The oldest piece of it that we're all familiar with is probably the Song of Songs, and I'll read just a little bit to remind us. Now remember, the Song of Songs was not written as a poem about the relationship between God and Israel. But if we remember that it's used as a poem about the relationship between God and Israel, we can see how this metaphor works. Just remember this language. The voice of my beloved, look, he comes leaping upon the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing in at the windows, looking through the lattice. My beloved speaks and says to me, arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. For now the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree puts forth its figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. O, my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the covert of the cliff, let me see your face. Let me hear your voice. For your voice is sweet, and your face is lovely. Catch us the foxes, the little foxes that run in the vineyards, for our vineyards are in blossom. Okay, and there's the language describing each lover physically in great detail. Extraordinarily full of sensual and sexual desire. And that language is used in the Christian tradition as a language about the desire for union with God. The medieval mystics are full of it. You know, medieval bridal mysticism, in which the mystics imagined themselves in union with Christ as bridegroom. They are in the role of the bride. Quite romantic, very, very sensual. And so what she's doing here, in a way, is drawing on a very, very old Christian tradition of union, sensual union with the good. And if we put her picture together, God doesn't come in here a lot. There's one little hint of spirit in here. With the work of Sally McFaig, and there's another book that is not on your list that you might want to look at if you want to pursue this farther. Sally McFaig has suggested that one way for us to look at an ecological spirituality is to imagine the world as the body of God, or the universe, or the cosmos, actually, as the body of God. So that the body of God is incarnate still now, right, all around us. We are in it, on it, and part of it. And the kind of meditation that Terry Tempest Williams undertakes in this quartet becomes a meditation then on almost the mystical union, the erotic union with God, remembering that God's body is the earth. Okay? For many of us, an unusual way of developing a spirituality or a piety around the environment, but also a very powerful one. Other thoughts on what you read and heard here now that you've been looking at it?
Well, one thing I noticed, she also, same similar to Dan Hyler, is the, Annie Dillard, the mention of time, that somehow
yes.
God is in time. Like this arch, this rock rising from the desert floor, is a creation of time, whether broken or beautiful. And Dillard before was the part that on that sheet, her questioning was, is God involved in time or not? Seemed to be her big question,
right.
Which...
In an ecological consciousness that becomes a cosmic consciousness, time suddenly looks an awful lot bigger than, say, from Moses to the present. You know, that's really pretty short. Time gets very big, and then the question of, well, how important is that little bit of time to God? Maybe not very after all, does begin to enter people's consciousnesses. We are not going to look at all of these. I want to go through only one of them. But Gerard Manley Hopkins, 19th century poet, kind of like Walt Whitman in his extravagant use of words, but unlike Walt Whitman in that he insisted in maintaining a very strict structure to his poetry, so that it's missing lots of the connecting words that would make it easy to understand. But what is marvelous about that is that it leaves the text marvelously rich, okay? And many different ways to interpret. For a theological meditation, I highly recommend the third poem on the sheet, because it is a marvelous and leaves a marvelous question. What would it mean for nature to be a Heracleitean fire, which is explained helpfully in the footnotes? What would it mean for nature to be a cycle, self-renewing, that never ends? And what would it mean for us to be a part of this and for God to be the God of that nature? I, however, want to read I'll read the first one, and we can talk about it for a moment and see what we find in it. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things, and though the last lights off the black west winds, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with, bright wings. What's here?
This poem I've been acquainted with, and since I first knew it, two lines that keep coming when I see mountains and anything beautiful is, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. That first line mm-hmm. is just magnificent. And then, there lives the dearest freshness deep down things, that hope of that the earth itself can always be renewing. It has that power within it, and equating that with God. But that's God's power within you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's very hope-filled in that way.
it's rather frightening to think that now we can conceive of the possibility that nature can be spent.
Right. Right.
It was still big and not in at his time.
Right.
For all that, nature could not yet be spent.
Right. We say that with hope and not with desirously or with a sort of guarded hope rather than with utter confidence now, don't we?
Yeah.
You know, we're not completely confident that this is really true.
It may be spent, but in a different form than what we know of it.
Right. The dearest freshness may not look like what we're used to seeing. There is still a sense that...
The tailing pile is an example.
Yes. Exactly, and that what evolves from that may not be the sort of thing we'd like to see or we're used to seeing. It may be something very different, but still within God's providence. Any other thoughts on this one?
What also kind of pulls together an immanent and a transcendent God. And
yes.
The charge of the grandeur of God within it, and yet the Holy Spirit broods over it.
Right.
So there's the sense of God working within the hand.
Right. And God's certainly letting us have our way, right? Whatever that might be, for a good long time here. Anything else in here that anyone wants to bring out?
I think it's an anachronism. I don't think this poem could be written today and be taken seriously.
It is. It does belong to another century.
I think the first half would definitely be taken very seriously, but the optimism of the second half, I think, is misplaced. I mean, I don't think it was misplaced then.
Right.
But a lot has happened since then. Yeah.
This is an old poem for sure, but the sensibility that exists in it is pretty contemporary considering the date, I think. This contrast and the anguish over what we've done is there. I don't know if all of you know this, he was a Jesuit priest and thought it was a bad idea and bad stewardship for him to take very much time to write poetry. And so people, his superiors and the bishops and people said, take time out, write poetry, please. You know, and he'd say, but I can't, I have too many important things to do. So he did write a lot of poems, and they are worth looking at. Their sensibility is a little bit toward the 19th century, but the power of the contrast, the beauty of the grandeur of the created world, and anguish over what humanity manages to do to it, and the connection of that to sin. Read Spring, and read the next poem, and the connection to resurrection is very, very important.
Is the last two lines remain true?
Yes.
Yeah. Any question?
The last two lines.
Yeah.
They remain true. And as long as they remain true, then the situation is not hopeless. I think. That's my
point. There is, yes, there is hope there. What exactly, how exactly we're going to work that out, or how exactly that will get worked out isn't clear, but the Holy Spirit broods.
Mm-hmm.
The mother hen, right?
We've been twirled, but...
Yes.
You think that there's no limit to how much abuse humans can inflict on the planet because there's something beyond the human that will spare nature.
No, I wouldn't presuppose that we can do whatever we want to do, but because the Holy Spirit is brooding over this bent world, and that includes us, because we're part of this world, that there is hope. That's the way I feel.
There's the possibility that we will be converted, right? And stop treading and searing and blearing and smearing and all of those wonderful words that he uses in that first stanza.
We started out by comparing him to Whitman, and I wonder, was I misunderstanding something about just Whitman's view of the world seems very different.
It is. I meant in terms of the extravagance of his use of words.
Okay, so just poetic technique.
Right, exactly. I didn't mean the world itself. Let's see. I'm being reminded by bustle in the hall that we need to stop. I want to say one thing and read one more thing. The gift of poetic language, which does not seem to us very useful in our busy world because it's ambiguous, is that it is ambiguous. When we make arguments about whether people fall, if we're going to have a dichotomy between God and creatures, do people fall on the God side or the creature side? Or if we're going to talk about do we have nature and grace, which side are they on? Our history and nature and all these divisions, we want to draw sharp lines. And the marvelous thing about poetic language is that it expresses much more accurately that there are similarities and differences that need not be identities and dichotomies between things. It enables us to have an understanding of ourselves as continuous with, but not exactly the same as, the rest of the creation. And it is very useful in that way. I'd like to end with a prayer that you all probably know, the Canticle of Brother Sun by St. Francis of Assisi, whom I would want to say is someone who belongs to the entire Christian tradition, because he came, well, just a little bit after the Great Schism, and certainly well before the Reformation. Another way of describing all the elements of God's creation as subjects in God's praise. Most high, all-powerful, good Lord, yours are the praises, the glory, the honor, and all blessing. To you alone, Most High, do they belong, and no one is worthy to mention your name. Praise be you, my Lord, with all your creatures, especially Sir Brother Sun, who is the day, and through whom you gave us light. And he is beautiful and radiant with great splendor, and bears a likeness of you, Most High One. Praise be you, my Lord, through Sister Moon and the stars. In heaven you formed them clear and precious and beautiful. Praise be you, my Lord, through Brother Wind, and through the air, cloudy and serene, and every kind of weather through which you give sustenance to your creatures. Praise be you, my Lord, through Sister Water, which is very useful and humble and precious and chaste. Praise be you, my Lord, through Brother Fire, through whom you light the night, and he is beautiful and playful and robust and strong. Praise be you, my Lord, through our sister Mother Earth, who sustains and governs us, who produces varied fruits with colored flowers and herbs. Praise be you, my Lord, through those who give pardon for your love and bear infirmity and tribulation. Blessed are those who endure in peace, for by you, Most High, they shall be crowned. Praise be you, my Lord, through our sister bodily death. Praise and bless my Lord, and give him thanks, and serve him with great humility. Amen. Thank you. Thank you.